Hello.
Hello, John.
Hello, John.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, this is Jeremy.
Hi, this is Jeremy.
Jeremy Shapiro.
Yes.
Yes.
Hi, man.
How you
You're
doing?
early, dude.
Yeah, is it too early
Is it
for
too
you?
early for you?
No, it's fine. Is it too late for you?
Well, it's like 3 in the morning
In the
here.
morning here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well done.
Well, I just wanted
I
to
just wanted
welcome
to
you
welcome you
to Stir the
to Stir the
Pots.
Pot.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. I had to check out the site the other day. Wow, you do a lot of work. You can't rest a lot.
It's not too
Nah, it's
bad.
not too bad. I try to
Post whenever I
post whenever
can.
I can.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here on a blazing hot Australian afternoon. What's it
Yeah.
like there?
It's fairly cold
Fairly
here.
cold here.
I'm probably in the
Probably in the
30s,
30s
Fahrenheit, so
Fahrenheit.
it's
Right.
a little
Right.
chilly.
A little chilly.
I think it'd be like 36, just been about 36, 38 degrees.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and we baked yesterday in that sort of temperature, the first day in my new oven, my new bakery, and it was, one of those baptisms of fire, fire all
Literally.
around, inside and outside.
And how did the
how did
bake
the
work
bake
out?
work out?
Well, it was okay. It was kind of saved, but I scorched all the bases of the unbleached white crusty bread that I do, which I call a casalinga. The tops were perfectly cooked, and they looked like the most fabulous, really like an Italian bread, that kind of pasta dura bread. But the bums were scorched up to even a millimeter, and some actually stuck to the oven sole, which I've only ever seen once before, and that's when we had the wrong tile on the floor of the oven, and they're a high alumina tile, and they're for kilns rather than ovens, and they burn the bread. So I'm just freaking out that the refractory people have sold me the wrong tiles, because there's, high alumina, low alumina, low highs for one way around. I can't quite get it at the moment. I think high alumina is for kilns and low alumina is for ovens, and if you get the wrong one, well, you get kiln action, which is not what I wanted. Anyway, the rest of the breads I kind of saved, but there was a bit of, because it was a hot day and it was my first day in there, and it wasn't as routinized as it has to be. There were some overproof bread, but people bought them and liked them, and so yeah.
As long
Good.
as the
As long as
customer's
the
happy.
customer's happy.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, well, I
Yeah,
just
well, I
received
just
your book
received the book
yesterday,
yesterday,
so
so
I
which
was.
is Natural Tucker bread book?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah,
Oh,
so
thanks for buying that.
I was waiting
I
for
was
it. I
waiting
said,
for
oh
it. I
boy,
said,
I
oh
hope it
boy, I
gets here
hope it
before
gets here
I
before
talk
I
to you.
talk to you.
Yeah, I wrote that in 1983. It's quite a while back.
And
Still works, though.
is it still
it still
relevant today
relevant
for you?
today for you?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Yep.
Okay.
All the recipes work, and I mean, apart from the design of the book, which I was furious about when it came out, and the various covers that went through as kind of a continual battle with publishers, but the content stands. And a friend of mine, George Byron, who's had that PDF that you saw, he owns Sunnybrae. He
Right.
said he thought there wasn't one spare word in it, which was high praise.
Well, I want to
Well, I
ask
want to
you,
ask you,
how did you
how
become
did
a
you
bread
become a
baker?
bread baker?
Great question. As one of those things, it just evolved, and I wrote a cookbook in 1975, in one of those early apocalyptic, mostly vegetarian macrobiotic type cookbooks, because I was on a part of that, the counterculture appetite for change, as Belasco calls it, and kind of a politic, realizing there was a big political agenda behind the food scene. It wasn't just all taste. And bread kind of, so I was cooking, but bread kind of struck me. It was fun. I was making the odd loaf, and then I did these sourdough loaves, kind of, which spontaneously happened from an apple juice ferment. And also in that brief period, one Easter, I wanted to make hot cross buns, and we were living way up in Byron Bay in northern New South Wales, and Splendour. It was beautiful there. It's sort of not semi-tropical. It's between subtropical and temperate. It's a beautiful place and magnificent surf and everything. And there was a local oven still operating, wood-fired oven. And one of my friends said, "Why don't you ask the old guy if you can bake there?" And I did, and it was just so awesome. And he was an old man, and he wasn't. I think he was, yeah. Within the month, those months, he actually got too sick to bake, and I had to close up the bakery, which had been running since 1896 or something. And yeah, so that all stuck. And kind of for me, you know, I just can't, like, cook. I sort of have to have an agenda. I was just so interested in the political agenda that I... And I thought bread was kind of this bottom-line food. Mm-hmm. And I looked at bread and thought, my God, it's poisonous, you know, and compared it to what I was eating and what I was starting to learn about bread. And it was Elizabeth David's English Bread and Yeast Cookery, really. I don't know if you know it.
Oh, yeah, I do. I have it.
Well, dude, I think it's kind of like the best book on bread. It's just, I adore her style and everything she does, even though she's been kind of like, stuff's been done to her in videos and things. But I, that was it. I read that and I went, yeah. But I had been making it before then, but that's kind of what made me seriously commercial about it. I'd been doing sourdough commercially, and it was kind of like a really left of center thing, you know. And only sort of the committed would buy it from my wood-fired bakery in a sort of hip suburb. But after that, I kind of like I realised the history of it, because I'm a historian as well. I'm a graduate in history, and I started to see, you know, as you look at the political system, what's happened to food, and you know, it all falls into place, and you're thinking, oh God. So I started doing more French and Italian breads, but also with this Celtic vein, because that's where I'm from. And we didn't sell any, you know, for 18 months or something. I got other jobs. I cooked for the Prime Minister and stuff like that. I did all sorts of things. And then all of a sudden, one of the food writers, one of the blessed food writers, said she just loved our bread and seen it in the market and how it was, you know, blah, blah. And I think my apocryphal story, we went from taking like $120 a day to like $3,000 a day in a day. So it kind of just commercially grew from there. And yeah, it was all part of my plan for world domination through bread, you know, and it's working.
and it's still working today.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really interesting. It happened, you know, it was a zeitgeist. It happened at the same time as the real ale movement. It all came out of, in my opinion, you know, countercultural thinking about the politics of food and like, oh, no, this beer's full of shit. Oh, this bread's full of shit, you know.
Yeah.
This cooking method, all the cream, sugar, blah, blah. And also because a lot of people of my generation had travelled extensively in India and Southeast Asia, and that food just makes you feel good. And you kind of have this experience of other food not making you feel so good when you come back, you know. And it all, you know, it was a time of re-evaluation. And what did Sandor Kraut call it? The quiet culinary mutiny going on. I thought that was a really interesting comment. And, yeah.
Why, for you at least, is a sourdough the best fermentation method?
For every reason I can think of. There's a huge nutritional agenda there. There's a huge digestive agenda there. There's a huge aesthetic agenda there. It all coalesces into this kind of like... the essence of, you know, a highly valuable and highly nutritious culinary item. It's got, I mean, I don't know if you know about the integral approach. I like to look at bread like that. And in every, from every angle you look at sourdough bread, it's really this big plus, 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 plus. And from every angle you look at conventional bread, there's an awful lot of minuses. I think in most cases, the aesthetic is the only thing which wins out. And that's kind of like a dubious aesthetic too, I reckon. So, I mean, I guess it was rational, but it was also, you know, emotional too. It's like, as I said, from an integral point of view, it contains all of that. You can invest so much in sourdough, and those reasons.
Why do you think then the bread industry itself is so against artisan bakers?
Well, they're just competition, aren't they? It's classic. As I said in one of my blogs, that about 1986, I picked up a bread industry pamphlet about, you know, plummeting bread sales, and because I was trying to interface with the conventional bread industry to try and get some juice, and it was like nothing, you know, and there was like brick walls and stuff, but I saw this pamphlet, and I thought, wow, my sales are soaring. And I knew a couple of other alternative bakers who weren't necessarily doing sourdough, but were doing, you know, what I call more real breads, just made from flour and with very little, if any, other additives, and fermented with yeast and salt, but that's all. And I mean, that's still, you know, that's still good bread. So,
So you're not then an elitist or a Luddite against, you know, yeast or commercial yeast?
No, it's just different, you know, there's different strokes, aren't there? And there's different, I mean, even though I think that stuff's crap and it actually poisons people, it's like, well, it's going to go on anyway, there's no point having that sort of attitude. I've been there and done that, believe me, and it's kind of like absolutely pointless. I just think it's important for us to develop what we have, our craft. And I mean, like your question was, you know, what's their attitude about? Well, it is competition, but also, I mean, the whole sourdough artisan thing, when it's done properly, it's a shimmering little package. It's very nice, and it threatens the kind of credibility, the inherent credibility of the whole bread industry, really. I mean, if I say too much, you know, they know. They all know from the inside, but they just kind of like turn a blind eye and get on with it because they've got to, you know, feed their families and stuff, and they don't have a sort of a political overview and things. But, yeah, I think they're not necessarily worried, but they're really looking over their shoulder. I write for an industry paper here called The Leading Edge, a magazine, and I mean, I'd like to do that. Once upon a time, I would have been just thought they were fascists, but now, you know, I like to do that because that's how it works, you know, interfacing, communicating, you know, opening up. So I get bakers writing to me about how to make sourdough culture and stuff, and they've, you know, they say, oh, I've been out in the country and, you know, I'd love to have done that and I've tried this and that, and I'm amazed because they're just regular bakers. But so, you know, in a way they've been denied their craft because they just get bags of premix, and some of them would actually like to be bakers. I mean, they used to come to me at Tuktaka and say, I only learnt to press buttons, but I'd love to know how to make bread, you know. Uh-huh. So there's also a segment of that in the industry who would turn pretty easily. Yeah.
How do you think trade schools are breeding artists in baking? Do you think they're really training properly?
Well, that's an interesting question. It really is, because, like I said in one of my blogs too, that they're not artisans, but they've developed an artisan course and are teaching artisan bakery. So that, on one level, doesn't make any sense at all, but on another level, it's a real even if it's a gesture, it's a step in the right direction. And a lot of those guys are really well-meaning. They're not trying to, you know, deceive or be crook, and, you know, that would be a bit of a paranoid agenda to think about. But so they can only go so far because they don't attempt to infuse the kind of mentality that I think that an artisan has, which is, you know, bordering on the mentality or the attitude even that, you know, an artist has. It's, you know, sourdough doesn't have to be, but, I mean, that's why I say from this integral point of view, it has the ability to be such a creative thing too. So,
yeah. How do you judge bread? What are you looking for in a perfect bread?
Oh, shit. Perfect. Yeah, there's that word again. I'm seriously critical, you know, about breads, and why wouldn't I be, you know? Never from an egoist point of view. It's kind of just from a, you know, evaluative. I really stick to that. Because, like, recently in a bread show, I was asked to judge these sourdough breads, and I didn't pass one, and none of them with sourdough breads, but I said to the other judge, I wish this was a yeasted bread category, because there's a couple of beautiful pieces of fermented yeasts here, which are really masterpieces of a good, proper yeast fermentation, were fantastic, but they weren't even slightly sourdough. Uh-huh. So, I'm not huge on external appearance. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that are giveaways. Like, as soon as I looked at the cover of Dan Leder's book, I knew he'd use yeast in his sourdough. Mm-hmm. You can tell, and that's not even a culinary kind of sensibility. When I first started baking in Melbourne, the, you know, ethnic people, Greeks and Italians particularly, Yugoslavs, used to come and stare in the bakery window because they knew the difference between a proper bread and a... And no Australians did at that stage. I mean, not many kind of like... I mean, people of, you know, industrial cultures do or can. So, you know, that's what I look for, authenticity, and I can look at it and go, oh, yeah, it's properly made, and it's got it. You know, the bottom line is that it's food. It's all that other stuff about it, but it is actually food, and I like to, it's a bit of a fundamentalist attitude, I know, but it's got to eat well, and it's got to have, be nutritious and properly fermented and all those things. For me, I mean, there's party breads, but I mean, my bottom line bread we're talking about here, it's got to be, good through and through.
Mm-hmm. I'm more a home baker. I went to school to learn how to bake.
And, right, yeah, I remember, read that, yeah.
And for me, though, eat other people's bread, I find myself judging their bread according to how I feel about my bread at home. And I think more and more I've been trying to stay more sourdough and really keep away from yeast, so I don't know if that's elitist or not.
Oh, of course it's not elitist. I mean, it's so easy to label everything these days and to cringe about it and that. I'm just not there. It's what you're doing, and it's really valuable, and I think it's really creative and enriching too. And I mean, heaps of kind of like therapists would agree that, bread making is therapeutic and stuff. Again, from an integral point of view, it's got so much going for it. And that's got to be because, it's mentioned, in verse 2 of the Bible, Genesis, Epic of Gilgamesh from the Sumerian myths. It's kind of like laden with bread, aphorisms and proverbs and symbolism. And they even say that, Gilgamesh goes into a cave and there's the wild man Enkidu, and he says to him, eat bread and it'll make you human. Frankly, that's what he says. So, there's that incredibly visceral one. It's a genetic connection, isn't it? Because, we, from whatever form of bread, particularly epigenetically, like for the last couple of hundred years, wheat and bread eating has been kind of like the staple. So it's in us.
Yeah, and when I was in Switzerland with my sister, I've been trying to get her into the sourdough, and I was watching these older women make bread in their home, this kind of country style home bread.
Fantastic.
And they were only doing a single fermentation, the bulk, and then they would just cut the dough and then throw it into the oven, unproofed. And I said, what a strange way of doing the bread. But they said, don't upset them. They're stuck in their ways. They don't understand.
Yeah, that's the kind of generation of, I think a lot of them, there was this time when people were suddenly relieved of continual labour and, we were given leisure time, God knows what for. Anyway, I could get fundamentalist there, but I mean, leisure time, what the fuck? when they could find something that happened in an hour instead of like the 6 hours or 7 hours they spent tending bread doughs and stuff, I guess I can sit and put my feet up.
It was strange. We've
go on.
I'm sorry. It was strange because they were making this pre-ferment. It was with like an old piece of dough, and then they'd add some yeast to it. And they'd spend the whole night waiting for it, and then the next day they'd make this dough. And I said, wait a minute, it's the wrong process,
And they were just kind of throwing an unproven dough in your...
Yeah.
Did you get to taste it or look at it?
I did taste it. It had a sort of green sort of taste to the bread.
All right.
Even though they grew their own wheat and everything.
Wow.
And it's a really great area of Switzerland because it's on...
Wow, where's this?
It's near Basel.
Ah.
Yeah.
And that's wheat-growing country?
They do wheat, but a lot of spelt.
Oh, really?
Yeah, spelt is like the main grain there.
So what were they making their bread from?
They primarily use some rye and predominantly whole wheat and some white flour.
What, not spelt?
Not like for this particular bread.
Okay. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. It reminds me of this theory of that great English baker, Walter Bamfield, that if you could introduce ripeness into a dough, you could bake it within a half an hour to an hour.
Uh-huh.
But, that's maybe what they were doing. Maybe they it's a taste thing they were used to, but it probably, who knows, interesting. Because, that idea of his about you can get 11, for example, like to the maximum point of ripeness before it starts to sour, and it's just, like perfect. And then basically just thicken it with flour.
Uh-huh.
And within an hour, you should have 100% ripeness, and you can then bake that. But I've done that lots, but there's an aesthetic problem with it. It's hard to control is the wrong word, but hard to bring out the best in it. It's kind of a good basic food, if you can do it that way. And,
when I first started going into sourdough, how people would describe how difficult it is to use sourdough and always depended on yeast as a crutch,
right,
sort of.
Yeah.
I still don't understand why that is.
Neither do I. Well, I have a diversion which may appear elitist or not. But yes, I know. I read and see this, and it's like, I just thought when I was first making sourdough bread. In fact, somebody came into our bakery when we were first baking in the 80s and, you know, really seriously into it. And he was, did Oriental medicine and martial arts as well, and he was there for, and a quite an awesome dude. He came in and he said, "Oh, well, this bakery's like Tai Chi." He said, "You're kind of like, everything flows in here, kind of like." And we used to think sometimes that if we, the more we stood out of the way and just facilitated it, it made itself. It was an eerie feeling sometimes. It was really eerie, but I kind of, and you know, people just think that's crap. Well, you know, that's what I experience, and it's valid to me, and I, you know, have seen it happen. So that's again another part of that magic thing. I agree with you. You can, it virtually makes itself, and it's incredibly easy. And but what I would attribute that to in another vein is I've noticed that some people can cook and some people can't cook. There's this line, you know. It's not necessarily hard and fast. It's blurred and all that, but there's this line. And some, you know, when you talk about smells or aromas, but some people just don't get it, and that's it. That, you know, they get other things, but as far as food, it just doesn't happen for them. So I guess that people like you and me who, you know, are into the experience of food, you know, it can happen. But if you're not really into food, it would be a hard and a difficult, and you wouldn't understand what was going on, and you wouldn't get all the cues and the signals and stuff, and you wouldn't be notice the smell of it changing and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that's historically a reason why people... It's strange. There's so many levels in this whole question that I have here. People have lost their sense of what it is to work hard, and therefore their food is not the same as it once was, meant for the family, meant to sit and partake of eating. It's almost like we've changed our whole diet according to the way we live today, and maybe it's the wrong. Some people are looking back and saying, hey, you know, maybe it's better to do it this way, a healthy way.
Yeah, like multi-levels, you're not kidding.
Yeah.
It's unquestionable that industrial food causes pathologies. Unquestionable, and many of them. And the other thing that is, like, really the big question is that a whole lot of these foods, additives and things, and we just don't actually know what they do because there's been no clinical evaluation of what eating, you know, too many, like rich and nutrient low and industrial refined foods does. I mean, you can see it because, I mean, I've been to India a lot and Southeast Asia and places where they don't eat food like that. And then when you come back into Western culture, if you can see it, you can see it. It's like, I'll tell you, I studied Indian music and my teacher came down to Australia to visit, and he walked around and he said, the first thing he noticed was, you know, and he said, why is everybody so depressed? And he was like, this really got him, and he was wandered around and looked at us, and he said, I think it's the food, because if you live in Southeast Asia and India, you know, for a while, and you get be there, this whole sort of different life, and there's a book called Shantaram, which kind of documents the sort of reality of this in a way. There's this whole kind of life there that we don't have in Western cultures. And I know, I'm absolutely sure that it's caused by food, micronutrients in particular. And see, the micronutrients are also the taste chemicals.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and you taste all this the industrialized food that doesn't have any of them in it. And those micronutrients, phytochemicals, whatever they are, they enable body processes which end up making, simply put, a more efficient human, you know, that just operates a bit better, you know, on all levels than ones who don't get those nutrients. I don't reckon that's rocket science, you know. And so, see, Guruji saw that when he came out here, and you talk to any Indians, and they've kind of, traditional Indians are quite aware of, they've seen this change happen when industrial food came to their country. And I heard this quite a bit through Southeast Asia, they'd noticed, you know, you don't see any poor skin anywhere in the villages of the third world, you know, and they live on fairly, you know, what we'd call subsistence food, but in many cases it's just brilliant, fantastic food. So you come, you go to one of the cities in, you know, Malaysia or somewhere, like, the first thing you see is bad skin. You know, and you look at what they're eating. Those kids are all hanging around McDonald's and that. It's not rocket science. So, you know, I mean, what level of that question do I keep answering? But, yeah, that's one of the reasons about sourdough bread. It's such an authentic food. It's got so much nutrition going for it. You know, there's a CSIRO, that's the Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization here. They were a government, they are a government body. I was did some bread with their head nutritionist here in Adelaide who was... is pretty on the ball sort of guy, and he had, they can't do pure research anymore. He'd love to, but there's no commercial application for him so far to do much about sourdough bread. But he's seen and he knows, for example, the effect of that. And I've seen a friend of mine, well, I knew him as an associate, really a journalist, came out of a diabetic coma because he was in hospital, and he said to his wife, "Get me some of John's bread." And he wasn't doing very well. And she said, she rang us up. I had no idea what's going on. She rang us up. She said, the doctors were amazed. This guy sort of started to come out of, slip out of this slide that he's going into. And he was just sitting in the bed kind of eating your bread, you know, slice after slice after slice. And it was kind of pumping him back into life. So, you know, and it's not rocket science again. It's not hidden information that, you know, type 2 diabetes, which is prevalent, and all those conditions that are like really prevalent, everybody goes to doctors for. Well, A, the doctor doesn't know whether they're caused by, you know, trans fats in what you've just eaten or any of the other, you know, myriad food and you know, fake foods. How do you do that? Follow that process through? They don't know. But nevertheless, there are people continually reporting with all this stuff. And again, you know, a lot of people agree with me that it's because if you have the experience of stopping eating, you know, industrial food, it, and like, have you read Pauline's new book, In Defense of Food?
No, I have, but I heard about it and I read some articles.
Whatever you think, like, he's thought about it, he cites this interesting thing that happened with these Aborigines here in Australia, that Kieran O'Day, this nutritionist, got a group of them together who all had diabetes and were going down big time, and said, let's go back and you just eat traditional food, go back to your tribal life and let's see what happens. And they all agreed to do the trial, and within 7 weeks none of them had diabetes and were all in a robust state of health.
Wow.
And all they ate was like food off the land. They didn't have anything. They had to get all their own food. They knew how to do it because they'd done it, but they'd... So he says, you know, it's an interesting book of his because he's kind of gone from being objective to being emotional, which I think is fantastic because food is so seriously emotional and so seriously not objective. And saying, and you know, in reporting this and at all, and so seeing that side of food that accepts the, it's one thing to say, you know, to rail against industrial food, blah blah, but then another thing to say, hey, it's, and more people are knowing this now, it doesn't really actually take long to undo the effects of that. And after like a 7 week or so period, I mean, you actually, people who've had the experience, and there's a lot have, they, you know, they kind of, you become kind of a convert, you can't help it, or and it assumes this kind of religiosity because you fucking feel great, and you know, feel better than you've ever felt really when you do that. And it's clear that the food's doing it to you. You know, it doesn't make you a transcendent being or anything, but you know, it just makes you feel better. And I know it.
Yeah, well, as a chef, for me, what I've noticed a lot in my industry is that, you know, a lot of people want to go to the markets and buy from the farmers, but for really generally cooks, it's really hard to do that because you're stuck with buying from purveyors who don't really give a toss about what you're buying, and organic's very expensive, and people don't relate to it as much as we really think. You know, people just eat what anything that's on the table, really, in a sense.
Well, it must be okay. It's government approved. It's there. It's, you know, got to be okay.
Well, who can trust the government, though?
Exactly. I mean, but most people don't think that, though. That it's just, that's kind of the prevailing ethos behind eating anything. Well, you know, it's got to be okay. It's there, isn't it? It wouldn't be, the government wouldn't kind of allow it to be there, or the authorities, or FDA in your country, or whatever. Ha ha. I was wondering what that's like being in New York and getting supplies. So you have purveyors, merchants who bring you
your food. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
And generally, you know, you'll get some good stuff, and then it's a hit or miss situation most of the time.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I'm not provided with the luxury of going to the market and buying my products, unfortunately.
Right. Are there markets there that you could do that?
Oh, yeah, we have a really great market downtown in Manhattan. Actually, there's really been a big sprouting of markets opening up in all of the boroughs of New York and even around the different states.
How fantastic.
Yeah, it's really becoming market-oriented, the food.
Oh, it's irrepressible spirit in a way.
Yeah, finally. Although I have to say, not all of the bread is really wonderful I've seen. Yeah.
Sure, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, do you get good sourdough bread? You must in New York. Yeah.
You know, I'm really too critical, I think, to judge that.
Oh, no, that's good. And that's what your job is. That's what you do, hey?
I did interview one baker, actually several in New York City. And, you know, a lot of people are doing the hybrid breads. I think it's because sourdough is, for them, I guess, is too much work. And everything's really a big business here. You know, you don't have the luxury of having a small bakery in each corner or each street, you know.
Really?
Which is always a kind of a question I put to bakers. Why aren't there bakeries in every neighborhood, like in the old days or even like in Europe, you know?
Right.
And it always comes down to, well, it's the money issue.
From what angle? What do you mean?
Well, that it's too costly.
To set up and...
Yeah, and you won't be able to make any money from it.
Right.
Yeah. Although one baker actually told me after the interview, he said, you know, I actually made a lot of money here at the market itself because he sells to all the markets from upstate New York all the way into the city.
Oh, right.
And he says, you know, I make more money here than I do in my regular business selling to restaurants and different places.
Yes.
So there's a contradiction, I think.
Yes. Restaurants are strange here. I've been to some restaurants and had really good food, and the bread's been unbelievably bad, and you just can't... The consciousness of the chef is just... How can they do that? You know, they'll have all this expensive, fantastic, blah, blah, blah produce, and there's this crap in the bread.
Well, I think it's because people don't look at bread as food anymore, and chefs don't know how to use it as an integral part of the meal.
Yep. And don't cook food which is actually compatible with bread anyway. I'm developing that whole theme of bread-compatible food, which always comes out to these traditional dishes. Of course they are.
Sure.
Because if, yes, you probably have, you see people in the back blocks of where, you know, culture still exists, that's how they eat.
Yeah.
Just chunky bread and these, like, all the food that goes with chunky bread, really. It's a whole... What sort of food do you cook fairly regular?
Well, I work in a really kind of upper crust private men's club.
Right.
And, you know, they're sort of traditionalist old men food. but I've been working there almost 12 years now.
Right.
And I've really tried to change a lot of the habits they have. And I mean, this week I made like a winter stew of lamb vindaloo, you know?
Oh, wow.
So for them, it was, they're not used to that sort of stuff, but they've accepted my kind of like strange culinary journey through food.
Oh, well, yeah, every restaurant needs one of you.
Yeah.
What about eating out in quality and, I mean, inherent quality, not just, you know, glitz quality? What do you do?
You know, I have this problem, too. I'm really critical of restaurants. I'll walk in, I'll eat a meal and just be like, God, that was awful. And my wife will go, Joe, shut up and enjoy it.
Yeah, right. I know.
You know, there's really good restaurants. I go to my little Vietnamese restaurant in Chinatown, which is dying away, sort of, but they've moved to a different part of New York now.
Yeah.
I really like ethnic food a lot. I mean,
Yeah.
I'll go to my little taco guy around the corner in my neighborhood, and I love that stuff, you know.
Yeah, what, has he got a small shop or?
Oh yeah, it's just like a little store, and the guy makes tacos, sandwiches, you know, Mexican sandwiches that are really wonderful, you know.
Oh, fantastic! Yeah, Well, that's what changed the food scene here. And I mean, I'm kind of was right on the edge of that too when all these immigrants came to Australia after World War II in the 50s. They just they're the ones who saw me baking in the suburb that I was in, and eventually, you know, I'd find out they had all these wood-fired ovens in their backyards, and they just thought, oh, we couldn't eat the food when we got here, no way. And, you know, all of a sudden all this food appeared that didn't ever used to be here much before, you know, from tomatoes up, you know, they sort of came here and just painted the place with food.
Well, I've kept an eye on Australian food scene for a while. I mean, I used to buy all the magazines, for the cooking magazines from there, and, you know, I first heard about Neil Perry, bought his book, and so I've always said, wow, those guys really are ahead of themselves, you know, and sometimes I think you guys are better than what we do here.
Well, it's interesting. Not a lot of that food works, though. It sounds great, looks great, can be written up great, everything seems great, but sometimes it really doesn't deliver. For me, in a nutritional sense, I so often, and that's also, and a dietary, but also a gustatory sense, I don't feel as though I've had a good enough feed, for example, because there's been too much ephemera paid attention to and not enough to central theme or something like that. That's how I view it. I mean, I studied macrobiotics with George Osawa, and that was just such a, I mean, if you want fundamentalism, I mean, God, you know, that was, so I carry that with me too. I like to be fed properly and nurtured. I don't care what it's, you know, I am.
Well, I think I'm lucky. My mom's French, and that's where I kind of learned to cook was by her side. I know a lot of chefs say that, but I've seen a lot of chefs who don't know how to cook.
Yeah, man, yeah. Oh, you know, you'd have the French paradox in you then, you know, you like food.
Yeah. Well, my dad's of Russian descent, and they're pretty bad, Russian Jews, and they're pretty bad cooks, so.
Yeah, right, yeah. Although, in Melbourne, we have a fantastic street, which is a lot of Russian Jews settle there and open cake shops or eateries.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the patisserie, well, that's where I really became intrigued with cooking that sort of food, because there would be some really unusual traditional items which, you know, used a lot of nutrient-dense and flavoursome ingredients, like, you know, plenty of walnuts and actual nuts.
Poppy
and
seeds.
Cherries and poppy seeds, and, you know, yeah. And so the food became less sugary, just white flourish. It was a more balanced food, and I really appreciated that. And the custards they would use, or those cream cheese slices, were just, and many of them were barely sweet. They didn't use a huge amount of sugar in them. And they were, you know, I learned a lot from the Russian Jews and Hungarian Jews. Melbourne was great. A lot of them came there after World War II, or, you know, escaped before World War II and came to Melbourne, and it's nothing like New York, but for here, being so incredibly kind of like really Anglo, particularly where I am, Adelaide, Melbourne is a far more Irish town, and so that's where everybody went, because, you know, it can happen.
Sure.
it's convivial and that, and I learned a lot from...
Well, we're actually losing a lot of those old European communities, because nobody wants to bake or cook anymore that way. I mean, we're really down to one famous delicatessen and maybe one or two bakeries, but that's it. It's basically gone.
In the 90s, really, that's morphing here. A lot of those, although there are some still there. I went and checked a couple of months ago, and they're still producing a really excellent cheesecake.
Yeah.
In the old way, but some of them, you know, they just adopt. Some guy from the company comes in and goes, oh, you could be making this easier with our premix, you know, cheesecake premix or whatever premix, and all you've got to do is add water or whatever and put it in the blender and, you know, jumps hurdles and, you know, whistles Dixie and you should use it, and they just do.
Yeah. That's pretty sad.
I had a market stall here, and, you know, I'd love to talk to you more about that too, because that's an extraordinary democratic scene. That sort of democratization of food like that, and getting it out of the hands of the food police and the food fascists and the culinary people, and all, is really, really an awesome move, I think. But
your son is also in the business, right?
Yeah, he's a baker now, a sourdough baker on the Gold Coast at Southport.
Good, keeping it in the family.
Yeah, I guess so. And I just found out about 3 months ago, my sister just idly said to me, she said, did you know that Grandma and Grandpa owned a bakery once? You're just joking. And I've got this painting that my great auntie did, probably 1910 or something like that. And it's of this dog, and I love it. And my sister said to me, hey, the dog is called Flour Bag. And I looked at it and went, oh, right, I get the humor. You know, I saw the dog, it's a white collie sort of thing. And how my sister found out about it was in the last couple of years of Mum's life, or the last year, she, you know, wasn't really clear on things. And she was driving with my sister past this shopping center, this area where I used to live in that area. And she said, oh, that's where Mum and Dad had the bakery. And my sister said, what? We'd never heard anything about it ever at all. And she had this lucid moment and said, yeah, they had a bakery in that shop there. And honestly, Jeremy, both my sister and I had been in that shop because it's a coffee shop now and had really liked being there. It was kind of, there was something that was great. I didn't think anything overly spiritual or, you know, but it was just a nice feeling in that shop. And yeah, and she said, that's the shop. And so, you know, they were wheat farmers. I know that. They came from Ireland to grow wheat here. Uh-huh. And on one side, anyway. On the other side, they were Irish policemen.
Oh, boy.
But, no, they were wheat farmers. So, I guess wheat farmers used to grind their own and make bread.
Oh, most likely.
Yeah, today it's incredible. You go to the countryside, you probably do. Nobody, unless you go to Europe and where, you know, there's food, or the third world, there's food growing everywhere. But here, it's like the farmers don't, you can't go to a farmer and buy radishes or something because they don't grow anything but their cash crop.
Yeah.
They're kind of not really farmers or something. Land techies.
I went to this mill in Switzerland, and that was my first experience ever going to a mill. And it was fantastic. The guy does only primarily spelt because he has the only machine that can take the chafe off the grain.
Right, the spelt, yeah.
Yeah, and he's a sixth-generation miller. And he's really wonderful guy. I mean, he started when he was, I think, 18, because his, I guess, father didn't want to do the business anymore. Yep. And he says, well, I want to. It's got to be kept in the family.
Right.
And it's just so amazing, because, you know, as a baker, or just to see that process, and then to be able to communicate with somebody in the language that I'm not, you know, really adept at speaking anymore. I mean, I was born in Germany, but I can't speak German at all.
Oh, right.
So it was great, you know, just saying a word like amylase, and the guy could understand me, and we, like, communicated right away.
Yep.
Great. And using that flour is so different than what I have here in the States and what's provided here.
Oh, I'd love to see that spelt flour and use that. Oh,
it's really wonderful. And
how intriguing.
I mean, I brought bags of flour just to bake at home.
I do too.
80% extraction. I was like, oh my God, you can't get that in the States, you know?
Can't you?
Well, you can, but not for, I mean, you'll have to get 50-pound sacks, you know? So,
oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, God, it's in natural foods. Well, we've got a fantastic mill in the state where I am called Four Leaf Milling, and that's been biodynamic since the 80s. We've kind of run a parallel career. I started using his wholemeal flour in Melbourne to make this sprouted wheat bread, which was immensely popular, wholemeal sprouted wheat. So we've got a wide availability. He's a brilliant guy too. He builds his own stone mills. We've got a wide availability of stone ground flours, and like that 85% extraction flour I love. In Melbourne, we used to make a very popular, fantastic loaf I called a crusty country. Uh-huh. So I just didn't want to go French because I wasn't there. So I'd gone to Australianize, or, you know, localize even the terminology. But it made a beautiful, I loved that bread. And we make, that's the flour I always use to make, you know, big bull, 3 kilo, 4 kilo loaves.
Wow.
That flour, I love it. It's ideal in a way.
Yeah, it has such a different taste. And I was going to ask you, if you grind your own flour, I have a little mill here. Can you sift your whole...
Yes, yeah, that's all you do.
Uh-huh,
yep.
Okay. All right.
That's all there. I've done that many a time to make the 85% or 80% extraction. And, I mean, if you go serious, you get linen, you know, and bolt it. They used to call it, you know, from a bolt of cloth too.
Yeah.
Bolt it through linen, and that's what rich people used to be able to do. So they had that, you know, English used to call it manchet, fine WHYTE, fine white bread.
Yeah, because I really love making big miches. You know, those are my favorite breads. And reminds me of the stories my mom told me about her village in France where during the war they'd make these giant loaves of bread for 1 week, you know, and have the communal oven and everybody make their own bread.
God,
bake off.
She, well,
yeah.
Oh, it's a nice heritage.
Yeah.
Some of us would love to have that. In.
Yeah, well, I wanted to go visit this summer when I was in Europe, her village, and then my back went out, so I didn't ride my bike down to France.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that would have been great. I was always so envious of Americans' ability to visit Europe because it's just across the ocean. Because, like, to go anywhere from Australia except Southeast Asia or India is kind of like a drama.
Yeah.
It's him to fight the US. I mean, they do take for. I once flew from Sydney to Boston.
Wow.
Man, and just overnighted in LA, and that was serious. So, yeah, and you guys can. What? How long? How far away is Europe?
It's
in hours. To
about 6 hours.
6 hours. To Europe. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It's not bad at all, actually.
Oh, it's really good. I think you only get somewhere in Australia from in 6 hours, where you get to Bali or Indonesia.
Wow.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, I'm going to have to definitely go down there because Graham's been kind of egging me on to go down and visit.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah. I got a couple more questions, really.
Yeah, right.
Bread related.
Yep.
What do you think this whole environmental thing is doing to our grain? Because, you know, people are using corn now to produce ethanol. And then the wheat prices are going up. Is it okay to maybe go into different kind of grains like kamut, spelt, triticale maybe?
Oh, I hate triticale. Anyway, we'll leave triticale out of the question. But kamut and spelt, God, yeah. Kamut, there's a fellow here growing it. We've just had such a serious drought that he's only got seed stock now, but I think he may have had rain. So maybe next year will be better. But he gave me a bag of unbleached white kumut flour that he'd bolted himself. Oh, no, he got the mill, that's right, they bolted it. So it was like, you know, 76% extraction, something like that. And it was just the colour of butter. It was fucking amazing stuff, man. And it made the most incredibly beautiful bread with a red crust.
Wow.
And you know that in antiquity, people have had access to that, have been making breads like it, but, and similar to the wholemeal makes it. So, yeah, well, they've got a huge place to pay, haven't they? Because they're kind of, I think they're trying, in Australia, they're finding that them and some of the old Persian wheats and things are really drought tolerant.
Uh-huh.
And some of them are these, what is it, C4 plants that they transpire. Yes. So, yeah, because, I mean, water's this huge issue here. I mean, you said that about environmental things, and, yeah, they are going to have to be used a lot more. But the other thing is that if we're going to have to grow food at all, the most efficient way of getting calories out of the grain, out of the soil, as we've already always known, is with grain, but then making bread from it, not feeding it to animals or,
yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't want to paint a past rural scenario, but, I mean, it's unquestionable, really, that humanity got to a point where they had this amazing agricultural system happening. I mean, they fucked up a lot, but nevertheless. So grains, I think bread could be center stage in any sort of environmental situation because, like I say, it's the most efficient way of getting food out of the ground. And whole grains, and made with sourdough bread, is kind of like the pinnacle of that because by fermenting, you know, wholemeal, kamut, wheat, spelt, sourdough way, you increase the nutrition of the thing. It's amazing. It's a brilliant invention of, you know, a natural invention of humans. And, you know, that the best part about the sourdough thing is that we didn't invent it. It was given to us. It was given to the first person who left out a batter or a dough to ferment, and they intuited that it was aerated and could extrapolate, which has happened lots in human evolution. And it was given to us. We've done, and then somebody's isolated yeast from it. But it was this. It's inherently as you can use the word inherently natural. Hey, and you know the wholemeal bread is just so nutritionally enhanced. And going back to that whole environmental question, it's centre stage really. And then, granted, wood ovens, you know, burn wood, but they never used to fell trees for the ovens. They were always pollarded and from waste wood. and these highly insulated wood-fired ovens now. I mean, if you compare the amount of bread you can pull out of one of those compared to the amount of bread you can pull out of a oven operated by electricity, then the price is just, it's so low for a wood-fired oven. Massive in all respects from an integral point of view for, you know, an electric oven. So, you know, sourdough bread may be this kind of like trippy thing, but, you know, I just think it's centre stage in reality. And, you know, especially future speak.
And it's really healthy that a lot of people are going into home baking. I think it opens up people's minds to saying, hey, I can really buy a really fantastic bread for myself. I don't have to go out and...
Yep. Even if you're using a bread machine, you know, people have said to me, oh, you know, I just make it in a bread machine. And I've always said, no, that's bloody fantastic, you know, because you're doing that. You're engaging with, you know, the cosmos in a way, and it's fantastic. But, you know, also you can't buy bread like you make because you've just got flour, water, salt, yeast, you know. All commercial bread's got crap in it of some kind. And, you know, poor quality too. So you can... My father-in-law, for example, was 89, and they're still making bread in a bread machine. And but he goes, his favourite mix, I mean, I can't believe it. This is the most regular guy you'd ever meet. Well, he's decided he really likes, you know, a third spelt, a third wholemeal, and a third unbleached white.
You know? Wow.
That's good news, really.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because my uncle, who unfortunately passed away, was kind of fascinated by my love of bread baking, and he tried my food, and he goes, do you make a good Jewish rye? You know, I said, well, yeah, sort of. And so I made one, and he goes, there's way too many holes in here.
Uh-huh. Yep. Well, yeah, there you go. The article I wrote, I don't know if you've read the blog thing about Holy Grail and Holy Bread.
Yeah.
Yeah, I met a baker recently when I went to George Buren's place at Sunnybrae, and he'd just sold his bakery. But George said to me, oh, he's a bit different, this sourdough baker. And I said, why? He said, well, he doesn't make that big holy bread. He makes, you know, bread that's kind of like, looks more like regular bread. And I discovered that too. And I kind of, that's a high art in kind of Anglo-Celtic culture. It really is. And that's how they really like their bread. I mean, I've discovered this rich and fantastic heritage of baking in Australia, which is an Anglo-hack. The whole, you know, everybody defers to the French, but there's this whole other world of baking that the English, it's really Anglo-Celtic. It's not just Anglo, because that's kind of more Germanic, but it's English. A whole school of bread making, are completely not French, and doesn't really concur, and it's all based on the use of balm. You know, that's my next fascination and investigation. I've already made some bread from proper balm, and it's really, really impressive stuff.
Well, I have a question about barm. Can you feed it regularly like a levain, or do you have to keep making it over and over? Is it something
it
you can perpetuate?
A lot, because there are polycultures, and it depends on how good your polyculture of those yeasts is, and it also depends on your management skills. And when I read the old bakery journals, I find that there are bakers who never had a problem with their farm, and because they all brewed as they baked, they were brewers and bakers, and they were continually brewing their own balm. And if they ran out, that there were various methods. You could either go and buy some from a brewer or another baker, if that was possible, a friend or something like that, or restart it. And so they talk about this whole process. It's all based on a malted wort, just like you brew ale, not lager, a top fermenting ale. And then because yeasts morph, you know, and you make them do lots of things. And so they, by introducing flour into that, the polyculture of the balm becomes more, it likes flour, you know, you train it to eat flour instead of the malt wort. And that's kind of what they did all the time, generated a Saccharomyces morphs of it, you know, polycultures of it, and, you know, a few other things. But I've had that bread, and I've purposely remade it again, and it's really good bread.
Yeah, I followed Dan Lepard's recipe for it, and I didn't have any really quality beer, so I said, oh, let me get some Guinness Stout, and it actually worked. I was surprised.
I haven't found that to be very effective myself.
Yeah.
Especially, and kind of in with respect to these bakers that I'm reading about, they that's not truly a barm process.
Yeah, it seemed like you have to heat the beer a bit and then add your flour to it. So right. I don't know.
I haven't read what Dan's written. What's that in?
I think it's in The Handmaid Loaf and also another book called The Cook's Book.
Okay. All
yeah.
Right.
But a friend of mine who we visited in Wales last summer, Bethesda Baking, he does his just from a little bit of the leftover beer at the bottom, the dregs, and makes his own little kind of beer culture.
Right.
And it seems to work pretty well for him.
Well, okay, but that's still not barm making because you're taking the top fermenting yeasts and they've got to be taken from the top.
Uh-huh.
On, have you seen him? You know Stephen Booner at all, that writer?
No, I don't.
He's an American. He's written a book called, I've just got it here somewhere, where is it? It's an important book to read on fermentation, I reckon, because it's, it's called The Sacred and Herbal Healing Beers. His name is Stephen Booner, Buhner. The subtitle, The Secrets of Ancient Fermentation. Talks about how beers were brewed, and then you start to get this picture of fermentation in the past and how it fitted into the bread scene too. I mean, people were totally aware of what they were doing and knew how it all worked. They may have had terminology which to us seems quaint and stuff, and they didn't know the equations, but they still knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
And they still knew all the nuances of how it worked, even if they couldn't, you know, write down the formula and stuff. It just didn't matter.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you read this, what Stephen Booner reports, and from what I've read from a couple of old bakery books, one I fortunately was given on from the Sourdough site, and others I've found, you just read them and... but this particular one actually documents a series of bakers in Melbourne who, and how and what they did with their barm yeasts and how they could, they kept a stock. They kept a stock yeast by, if they got a good batch, they'd wash it, which is just a process of adding water and then pouring the water off kind of thing. But that seemed to keep it clean from contaminants, because the whole aim of this was not to have what they called a twang in your bread.
Uh-huh.
Didn't want any sourness in there. But, so I'm intrigued with all this. It's really, because it's a hot... And do you know where I first saw it? I was reading the Roman historian Pliny, and he travelled to Gaul with Caesar. You know this story? You're not, is that familiar with...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm a real history buff.
Oh, me too. Well, he travelled to Gaul with Caesar in those first campaigns and documents to some extent the life of the Celtic, so-called Celtic people. And the big thing that blew the Romans out was in France, that the Gauls were making this bread from beer yeast, and they were astonished. They'd never seen it before. And not only that, they thought they loved their bread. Which is really interesting because the Romans were pretty good at utilizing grains and, you know, were good at making bread. They'd inherited, you know, all that stuff from Sumer and Egypt and Greece and absorbed all that technology. And so they, you know, and we know from Pompeii it was a kind of a really efficient system, you know, similar to what we're doing now, really, except we don't have slaves to mix the dough and stuff. Although sometimes they think they are. But, yeah, so, you know, it's this ancient way of making bread which totally parallels sourdough, but it enabled kind of industrialization of the process, and so it just died then fully, completely. As soon as they started, Pasteur and company started line breeding yeasts, this all started to die, but it was still going on in Melbourne up until World War II seems to be this demarcation line, doesn't it? You know,
yeah. In
so much of culinary history, it's kind of like after the... Well, you know, some people say that many of those villages in Europe were actually medieval until World War II happened, and that was the big... thing that, you know, knocked everybody out of the old world, and so much because you don't hear or see, or there's nothing about this type of bread making in Australia post World War II, but there is right up to it and during it, and then gone within, you know, by the 1950, the industrialization of food happens, corporatization of food happens so fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, that nutrients go, and it's all about appearance and shelf life and convenience and all that stuff. So all the micronutrients, which, you know, we now know, you know, create neurons and stuff, Jeremy. Jesus.
Oh,
and
God.
Really. Yeah. They just went.
Well, it's funny because my mom told me during the war, at the end of the war, when the Americans came into her village, they were giving out like white bread and made in these horrible factories.
And, yep.
And everybody was like throwing it away, saying, "God, this is crap."
Really? Wow, what a good story, man.
And my mom always says, "God, I always remember how bad the bread tasted, but we were so hungry we just ate it because we needed something to nourish ourselves because the Germans really had destroyed, you know, everything around."
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, incredible.
When are you going to be writing another book?
I'm right in the middle of it.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to get it complete. I've just given a huge draft to my... I'm not separated from my wife, but we're still great friends, and I've just given that to her for proofreading. And she said she thought it was really good, needed, you know, the usual tidying up and arguments about. But and there's another two sections of that to go on to finish, and I'm just... I'm in the middle of it, Jeremy.
Yeah. And how is the bakery going so far?
Well, one day. I've only been in there one day yesterday, and I mean, I made... The Irish fruit bread I made was fantastic. So I had that beautiful flour, the wholemeal overproofed, and my Casalinga, my unbleached white crusty sourdough, and the bums got burnt, but scorched, but the tops looked beautiful, and the bread was really, really good.
So you're just getting your feedback into
it. I am. Yeah, and this oven's a bit idiosyncratic. It's going to take me a bit. I've mega insulated it, and yesterday I fired it according to my old oven firing principles, and I think I just instantly created this massive reserve of heat which would not go away.
Wow.
You know, it's always better to have a hotter oven than a cooler oven because you can cool it down, but my aim was to mega insulate this so it would be, you know, hugely efficient, and I think it is. So that's why I got this scorch. Either that or I've got the wrong sole tiles. We'll see.
Yeah, my sister has a heating baking oven in her house in Switzerland with these really fantastic stones that they got from Germany.
Right.
And I baked some bread in there the first time, and we sort of got it too hot. It kind of scorched my bread, but...
Okay. What, is it electric, gas, wood?
No, it's wood.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, they're all in all the Swiss houses, they have these, like, giant ovens in the house that you can bake your bread on, but also heat the house internally.
Oh, do you know the animationist Miyazaki, Japanese?
No, I don't.
Oh, shit, he's got a fantastic, extraordinary piece. It's the only animation I like. I don't like any manga or any of the Japanese. I hate it, but this is transcendent. It's called Kiki's Delivery Service.
Uh-huh.
Oh, if you could ever get the DVD and watch that, man, it's set in a bakery, and I think, you know, I keep thinking, where is this, where is this? There are a few clues, but it's kind of like Central European, but it's, I think, Swiss, and one of the women in this, the old woman's got such an oven in her house, and Kiki bakes something in it, but it's set in and out of this bakery. It's a absolutely beautiful piece of animation. Yeah. And the bakery scenes in it, you'd love it, you'd really love it, yeah.
Yeah, there's always a bakery that I stop by in Basel. They have like these really fantastic bread that they put like plums in. It's always, whenever I go there, it's like the plum season. And they make these like spelt breads with plums in them. And
really?
Yeah, and I ask
them. As a crusty loaf of sole bread or tin bread? Or
Some of them are tinned and then some are like baked in. They're like natural freestyle loaves.
Okay.
But it's really tough to get bakers to let you look at their bakeries, I found.
Oh, yeah.
In most of the
world. Oh, yeah.
In most the of the world.
Okay, but the bakery... sorry. I have to ask you about that. What proportion of plums... I don't know this, and I'd like to do this.
Yeah, they seem to put pieces of plums inside the bread itself, and they bake them inside.
Right, throughout the texture?
Yeah, pretty much. I think I have a picture of it on my camera. I'll send you a photo.
Awesome. That's right.
And they make some really fantastic breads in Switzerland. They're just a lot different than in Germany. And but that whole corner of where my sister lives, it's like you're near Alsace, and the south of Germany, near the Black Forest.
Right.
And you get these really fantastic breads there.
Yeah. People have said to me, because I live in Australia and, you know, I don't have European bread culture and names, and I kind of resisted French namings and stuff and have attempted to name a lot of bread sort of as it came here and colloquially and locally and, you know. But a number of people have said that my bread is very Swiss. I don't really know what that means, but a number have said, no, I've seen bread like this in Swiss. One guy in particular who really knew bread, he said to me, no, this is really Swiss-style bread, mate.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, that's a good compliment.
Is it?
Yeah.
Great, well, right, 'cause I don't know.
Well, I went to the French-speaking region this last time, and we went to this bread museum. And, wow, it's... The cultures are so different, and yet the country is very, you know, small, but there's such a variety of, you know, rye, spelt, and wheat in different regions, so it really is a variant on all kinds of breads they do there. Well, I don't want to keep you much longer, because I know you're going to have to bake in the morning.
No, I'm not.
You're not?
No, I'm not baking for a week yet.
Oh, okay, so you just...
Yeah, the business, I'm starting up slowly, and I've got other things to do, and I'm not sure whether I'll be baking fully within a week or two, or whether I might give it about 4 weeks to wind up and just make sure everything's right with, you know, deliveries, wholesaling, publicity, blah, blah, all the stuff you've got to do to get by these days. And I'm still not sure whether I'll be largely wholesaling or how much input I'll have in the eatery, because like I've got a beautiful old cottage there, which I think I'm going to do. It just depends if the guy makes me a good enough offer to do it. The guy who owns it has facilitated the bakery and everything within his premises. So he's got the other part. There's a restaurant part, and there's this old cottage. And I want to do bread-oriented food in there and kind of really expand that right into, you know, long Sunday lunches and do all sorts of different breads, not to, you know, fill it up with bread, but to have it as an integral component rather than just an aside.
Yeah.
So I'm working on that, and I hope I can get that and he makes me a good enough offer, because that'll be fantastic. I really want to do that.
Have you heard of a pain quotidien? Yeah.
Sorry?
It's a kind of a restaurant, and they have from, it started in
Belgium. Oh, pain quotidien, yes. I have, yeah.
Do they have that in Australia?
Yes, there's three of them in Sydney, I'm told. Uh-huh. I was quite alarmed about a month ago, because I've been sitting on that concept for a long time myself and wishing I was somewhere where I could do it. And Graham told me about them, and I got onto their website and went, oh, shit, to do that.
And yeah, one of the big chefs here in New York, Daniel Boulou, he's also starting something like that, but more in a French vein, where they sell like pâtés and really good bread and have that kind of communal feel. I think it's becoming a new thing here in New York.
Well, same here. We've got two big refectory tables and a massive refectory table for our place. It's the theme is big table. You all were in here to, you know, you don't have to look at somebody. You can sit over that table if you like, but nevertheless, the focus is this big table. I like the feel of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's cool. I like, yeah, that's interesting what's happening.
Yeah, in London, I went to St. John's, Fergus Henderson's place.
Right.
And he had a really great concept, too. They have a bread bakery within this kind of, like, restaurant. And in the morning, you could have really typical... bacon sandwich on a toasted sourdough bread with a homemade ketchup. It was really nice, and I really like the gritty kind of like simple white interior. No paintings, nothing, just a menu. It was really nice. And
London's good at that. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is it called?
St. John's.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's Fergus Henderson who's the
Fergus Henderson.
Yeah. I think Dan Lepard had been the initial baker who started them up there.
Right.
Yeah. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, I had a bakery cafe set up in when I had my Natural Tucker bakery, the first one in Melbourne. We'd done that and put a cafe in various incarnations next to it, and that worked for a while. I got distracted to do other things, so I didn't focus on that.
And how far are you from the city now?
45 minutes.
Ah.
Yeah, and 20 minutes from the wine growing area. Maybe it's 50 minutes to the city, 50 minutes an hour, you know, something like that. wine growing area where I work's just 20 minutes where the bakery is. So I'm really fortunate. I'm just renting a house out on that 1¾ acres. I've got a big vegetable garden, fruit trees, and huge eucalypts around me. And I'm on the southern side. It's a microclimate. I grew up here and I know this place really well, but I didn't know this microclimate. It's on the southern side of the central range of hills, and it faces south. So it's got all this southern oceanic weather, you know, evening. Right. It's milder here. It might be 44 down there. It'll be, you know, 38 here. And it has been this summer, 44 and 45 in Adelaide. But in the afternoon, and often just when it gets hot, this amazing cool breeze comes in off the southern ocean. And sometimes in a very hot day, this extraordinary, you know, cool enveloping mist rolls in too. And I love that, the idea of microclimates. And I'd been living on the other side of the range down in the wine growing area, and it's seriously Mediterranean. Travellers have told me they think it's a lot like Crete, really, the closest they know of it. It's pretty dry but brilliant grapes and brilliant stone fruit because there's underground water and there's good winter rains, but it's very dry in summer. But yeah, so that's very much hotter down there, of course. And yeah, this is a really different place to live, with different winds, you know, and facing south and stuff. But yeah, my vegetables are, you know, they're a month or so less, and you know.
Well, one of my favorite cheeses is from Australia, the Roaring Forties.
Pardon? Roaring Forties. From King Island.
Yeah, it's really wonderful cheese.
It is. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, is that a blue cheese?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, right. I remember it. Yes. Haven't had that for ages. So, you know, funny thing happened with that company. When whoever the chain in the US decided they wanted them, well, they got most of the produce, and we hardly see it.
Oh boy!
It is around. I know you can get it, but it's not. See, again, where I live down here, there's a biodynamic dairy who make, you know, fantastic cheese. They're Germans, German hippies who came here after the Red Brigade stuff and all that went down, and they're really into biodynamics and have learned it, studied it, and applied it, and, you know, just making, so we get brilliant biodynamic milk, and butter is to die for. And now they're making these brilliant cheeses. They're only making a few soft ripens, Camembert Brie styles and Gouda style. But, you know, because everything they do is perfect, you know, the cows are milked to the white face of the moon and everything, they have this amazing dynamic. You know, there's another company down here who just have Jersey cows, and they make a Gouda too. And I was just comparing the two of them, and, you know, it gets into the etheric when you talk about this produce from biodynamic farms and, you know, all that. It's just got this energy and a dynamic to it, which I don't know. I'm not good at quantifying that in kind of like regular terms, besides, you know, like amazing and shit like that. So, you know, I'm pretty fortunate here, mate.
We have a lot of really good local farmers, too, in, like, New Jersey and stuff, and even Vermont. I mean, the cheeses here in the States, I've been thinking, wow, we have some really amazing cheeses, and sometimes it's overrated to go buy something from overseas because it's right here local, you know?
Totally. Oh, that's interesting because that's paralleled the bread thing, too. It's, you know, we're not good at, you know, seeing history as it happens, but it's, you know, there's a... I perceive a really historical thing, like, you know, you're talking about cheeses and we're talking about breads, wines, everything. That's only happened since World War II, and only really has happened since this, you know, countercultural stuff was first, like, seriously mooted. And, you know, people opted out and went on communes and stuff, but I'm not saying that was, you know, seriously causative, but it was hugely influential in the movement back to a country life and the farm and, you know, proper foods, because, you know, you can get those fantastic cheeses here, which didn't exist, and we can here, and they didn't exist 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. There's nothing like that. And I mean, I can get these fantastic goat cheeses, which were taught to a local cheesemaker by a Swiss guy, you know, soft ripened white goat cheeses. I adore them with sourdough. They're just, you familiar with them?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we get a cheese here in the States. It's called a Humboldt Fog.
Right.
And it's the most amazing cheese. It has, like, I think it's actually sheep, could be sheep cheese.
All right.
But it's like has like an ash in it, and then and then it's like a dry kind of cheese in the center, and then on the outside it's kind of like gooey with a really hard rind.
Oh.
And once it sits at room temperature, it's like it's like an experience of the sexual nature.
Is it very odorific?
Somewhat, but...
Like a Tom or something like that?
No, not really. It's gooey, but yet has a soft chev kind of feel.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
It's really like fantastic. Or
oh, man, fermented foods have got to be the most interesting things on the planet if you're interested in food, I think, and have a curiosity.
Oh, definitely.
Oh,
yeah,
cool.
When I was at that Miller's place in Switzerland, he gave us some spelt beer from central Switzerland.
I've had that. Oh, well, I don't know about that, but yeah, go on.
That stuff was so bizarre taste, and my brother-in-law and I were like, wow, what is that stuff?
I went to Melbourne, I went into a cafe, and I wanted Guinness, I think, and he said, oh, we've got this, and he brought it out, and they didn't know what it was, and it was this German beer with a red label. It was German writing. That's all I knew. I couldn't understand. But then I saw the word Dunkel.
Oh, yeah.
Shit, this is spelt beer, and it was. I'd never tasted it. It was awesome. It was really beautiful, made, well finished, you know. Not too kind of like serious. It was good. In more regular parameters.
When I was in the army in Germany, I mean, my favorite was going to this restaurant where they had this like special pork meatloaf. And at the table, they'd give you a big basket full of different bread, salt, pretzel styles. Caraway seeds and your big liter size mug of beer.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Oh, I reckon.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to read through your book the rest of the morning.
Oh, yeah, cool.
And, you know, I love that stuff that you had on the Sunny Bray PDF. That I found.
The recipes there?
Yeah, because there's some stuff there that I said, I've never heard of this stuff, and I had to Google everything.
Yeah, I'm starting to get into that, kind of just pushing the limits and boundaries and a bit. Yeah, the chocolate bread was, to me, I was astonished because as soon as I introduced the raw organic cacao powder into my leaven, it loved it. So I grew this chocolate leaven. And I was astonished at how vibrant it was, and then it went on to produce this really well-fermented little bread. I want to refine that recipe. That was a bit too experimental, but I was just talking about innovation in baking because, you know, it's useful for me, a person like me, to introduce that to other bakers who might not have the time to think about it because you can drive the wheel a bit, you know, and they then start making it and doing versions of it, and so things move, and I think that makes food interesting.
It's like an evolution.
It is.
Yeah.
It is, for sure. Well, you know, I got that idea. It's not like I invent this stuff. It's kind of like I realized that the Aztec and Maya, I'm not sure, both of them, those pre-Columbian Americans, put the chocolatl in with pulque. Maize fermented brew, and that made me think. And what's the vanilla, honey, and chili as well?
Right. Yeah, so, I put in my chocolate desserts. I put like espalette peppers or cayenne. You know, because
right
it's
on.
Such a great flavor. You know,
it is incredible, isn't it?
My really wife's awesome. From Ecuador, and she makes this hot cocoa for me with star anise and cinnamon and cloves. It's fantastic.
I've only had that once from one like that. Yeah, it was cinnamon one. But
Yeah. And when I was in Ecuador, I met this organic farmer. He grows his own cacao and makes these different candies out of pure sugar cane. And fantastic chocolate. I couldn't believe how good it was. It was so deep, the flavors.
That is, that combining cacao with what they call rapadura, the...
Uh-huh. Yeah, the sugar.
Cane juice.
Yeah.
Those were you know, white sugar hasn't got a place in there, in my opinion. That is what should be with chocolate because the combination of all those millions of, you know, taste chemicals and phytochemical blah, blah, micronutrients, antioxidants, all the stuff they're now going, oh, blah,
sure.
blah about chocolate. Man, you just taste that. And, you know, I mean, those stories, those people weren't stupid. They didn't feed it to the emperor so much, you know, for no reason, because none of it, everything used to be so pragmatic. You know, we make stuff up now, but nah, they didn't make stuff up, you know, in a dietary sense ever. It had a function, you know. And so yeah, cacao. I got some fermented, untouched, treated or anything wild cocoa beans from a friend here just last week at the market who imports them, and they're insane to eat. They're just so many flavors, and they're fermented, and so there's incredible range of flavors, and they're easy to eat. The texture's like crunchy and interesting, and you know, I thought this is incredible. And about 20 minutes, it felt like a trip coming on or something. I said, "Say what?" You know, and I don't, because you know that stuff's got anandamide in it.
Yeah,
cocoa.
Yeah.
And I just felt, it's the first time I'd felt a euphoria. And I mean, these are really, like I said, they're from wild cacao trees in, I think Thailand. I'm not sure, or Indonesia. And they've just been picked and fermented and then exported here. You've probably had nibs in it, but these are the kind of rawest nibs I've ever had. All I can say is I was walking through my garden thinking, well, I've got to, what's in this cocoa?
Yeah, well, the combination of chili and cocoa is so fantastic. It does give you this, like, wow, what is that?
I agree. It's a really, it's a sensory experience and, you know, verging on euphoria, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Well, this guy that I met in Ecuador, he also made this wine from oranges. It's more like a liqueur. But unbelievable. Just
from what?
From oranges.
Oranges, okay.
Yeah. And they have this of different variety than, you know, what we're used to here in the States.
Yep.
And he took me through his garden and he's like, oh, try these little bananas, you know? And I don't really like little bananas here because they always taste like, you know, they've been grown on some crappy farm and they don't taste, you know, real.
Oh, yeah.
And they always have this weird hard feeling to them.
Yes, I know. Dry, hard feeling. Yes,
yeah.
I know.
Pulled this thing off the tree and it looked, you know, a little mottled with brown spots. And I said, oh, okay, I'll try it.
Yep.
My God, it was like gold.
Banana candies. I know
yeah.
them. So
yeah.
we had them up around Byron Bay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is really, oh, you know, man, some of that fruit, since when I first got to Southeast Asia, you go into a village and you taste some of the you know, the fruits and it's eye-opening. A pineapple, I could never eat pineapple and I can't here in Australia because it makes my mouth bleed and ulcerate.
Uh-huh.
But in Malaysia, the pineapples taste like pineapple candies. Sweet, and you know, it's a climatic thing. They kind of shouldn't, and I don't think they know how to grow them here. But
right.
When you get to places like that where, you know, I don't know, whatever, that there are smaller pineapples, maybe they'd sussed the varietal stuff, but they tasted just like candies, what we call lollies, pineapple essence, you know. They were, and I had, in India too, my God, I used to have every morning, sometimes three glasses of lassi with some pineapple because, you know, pineapple and buffalo curd yogurt, the pineapple taste is, I was sick, you know, and it was just so curative.
Yeah, in Ecuador, the pineapples are really big and they're white. And they're
just, are they?
Yeah, it's great. And all the seeds are popping out of them when you cut off the rind. You look inside and they're like little seeds everywhere. You're like, wow.
Wow.
They're fantastic.
That's totally different to what I know. What's their flavor like?
Just like sugar.
Okay.
Pure sugar. Yeah.
Ah.
And the really greatest thing is they have, everywhere you can get sugar cane, and they make a thing called guarapo. And it's a fermented drink as well. And my brother-in-law has bronchial asthma. And we met this kind of shaman out in the woods one day, and he gave us this curative for him. And we asked him what was inside, and he said, oh, there's coca leaves in here, so those are really good. And he had these weird roots inside, and my brother-in-law was, oh, yeah, this should be good. And he drank it with a little bit of the hard alcohol and that, and I said, forget it. It looked just too nasty. It was, like, really dirty looking.
Wow.
But he said the next day his lungs completely cleared up.
Yeah, what? Not uncommon. Yep.
Yeah.
The only person that could fix me of, you know, when I was sick in India, was a herbalist.
Yeah.
The antibiotics and doctors and everybody else. Nah, all the bugs go, oh yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Herbalist got me right within a day. I started to feel better. I had a post-monsoon viral fever. And he was also, you know, he's my music family in Varanasi, they're Ayurvedic physicians as well. So I just went around to see him and I was really sick, and he just looked at me and said, "What's wrong with you? You look terrible, blah, blah." I sat down, took my pulse, did all the stuff and that they do, and gave me these vial powders. And that night, and yeah, about three days I was better, and he directed me to the one guy in the city who sold buffalo milk, cauldron of buffalo milk and raw sugar.
Oh, wow.
Oh, this is the most, so healing. I love those experiences. I envy you being out. Sounds like great being in Ecuador.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful there.
You encounter things.
Well, I've encountered bad things with my stomach there, so I'm not used to the little bugs there, but it's always an adventure going there.
Yeah. Sure. Do you know those Japanese umeboshi plums?
Oh, yeah.
And do you use them at all in the...
Well, I've used the umeboshi when I worked at Sony here in New York. The sushi chefs used to work with that a lot.
Okay. Right. Yeah. I just always have them in India and Southeast Asia and places like that. They really help with bad guts and stuff. Huge.
And yeah, usually I'll have papaya in Ecuador, and that always helps.
Does it? Oh, well, yeah, right.
Definitely.
I'm at a... I am in Calcutta in India. I met this Japanese guy, and it was so hilarious because I'd been in macrobiotics and I knew all about, you know, the traditional Japanese food and cooking and stuff, and I had this umeboshi extract with me, which is like really pricey and highly priced and all that, because it's brilliant for when you get crooked there. And we were just in my hotel room talking and stuff like that, and somehow that subject came up, and it's called Baniku Exu, you know, it's a plum extract, and somehow he said something. I said something about, anyway, and he went, he just looked at me in utter disbelief and said, "You have Baniku Exu?" I'm like, "Yeah, I do." And showed it to him. And he goes, "Oh, God, you've got the best variety, too." Because I had this, you know, number one macrobiotic one. But I always loved it because it was this fantastic meeting of culture. And, you know, you kind of, I love seeing stuff like that. Him, Japanese, me, Australian, both had this plum extract there for the same reason, to protect our guts and things. It was really great.
Yeah, it's like my back. I finally went to this acupuncturist, and she's cured me before, and I swear by it. I don't care what anybody says. Man. Yeah, it works.
Okay. Sensational, good energy medicine and stuff, yeah.
Definitely. One more thing.
Yep.
The ABA. What is that going to do to help sourdough get its place in Australia?
I think it's a push for some sort of authenticity in the face of the industry hijacking the whole artisan agenda. And, of course, that's definitely happening.
Yeah.
And that's why I've been writing stuff about, you know, you can't just call yourself an artisan.
Yeah, it's kind of like music. They always want to take a good thing and make it their own.
Or anything, absolutely everything, will be industrialized, corporatized, you know, and that's the nature of the beast in the game. So that's a way of Graham trying to step in and organize something and get interest and try and create kind of, you know, a more official level and a kind of, sort of some kind of standard.
Sure.
And that's apart from being, you know, almost a guild thing. It's also great for customers because, you know, people who eat my bread sometimes are astonished and they say, "I thought I'd been eating sourdough bread." You know, they've been eating the crap that those people make and, you know, call it sourdough. It's kind of like, it's actually a deception. It's a misrepresentation because it's clear taxonomically what sourdough bread is. It's, you know, it's defined by the absence of Saccharomyces yeast. So you put Saccharomyces in it and it's not sourdough bread. It's got, you know, people say I'm a purist, and I'm like, I'm not. It's simply about calling a spade a spade. Is that a purist? It's not at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah.
Will there be a guild in Australia?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. You know, I saw a program the other night on what are they called? Oh, they've got some fantastic name, the Guild of Bakers in London.
Uh-huh.
And they're an ancient 14th century, given their charter, I think. And they have this great, eccentric name. So, and, you know, they still exist in that. But, I mean, that's not about quality anymore. Once upon a time, there was an unstated and non-academic, just kind of this inherent kind of or instinctive standard. And it was about quality within bakers and bread. And I think Graham would like to sort of see something like that happening. I mean, it's so difficult because, as you say, everything that gets invented here suddenly gets reinvented with fake ingredients, like, you know, your country, mine, it's the...
Sure.
The capitalist industrial cultures, that is what's going to happen. So, and there'll always be this conflict or a line between, you know, the authentic and the ersatz product. And I think that's, you know, what Graham, I'm about and Graham's about. And I think that's what kind of would, AVA is, yeah, like I say, the cycle goes around. I say a lot of those bakers are already compromising.
Right.
But you know what astonishes me? There is no need to compromise. That's all made up. Uh-huh. The sourdough processes don't need shortening. They are well tolerable within a conventional working day and an employment infrastructure that we have, and they are cost effective. That's not to do with reality, you know. That's to do with attitude. It's made up.
So they're just being lazy.
Exactly. Like the rest of society. I mean, one doesn't like to say that because it makes you come kind of a judgmental or a fundamentalist or whatever, but, I mean, it's observable, like I say, about leisure time. I mean, what, to get fat and obese and stuff? I mean, what happened to this joy in your livelihood and, you know, not perfecting it and having to see it in didactic terms, but, you know, being good at it and competent at it and proud of it and it having a place within culture? I mean, that's been belittled so much and debased and, you know, falsified.
You're providing sustenance.
Sure.
Yeah.
In the real sense, yeah. You know, in the integral sense, again, where there's everything into play from familial values and associations to nutrition to the aesthetic to, you know, a bigger cultural value in that you then relate that to other people within your sphere. And it's, you know, more than a conversation piece. It kind of, well, what I'm saying when I'm writing is now is that this is imbuing things with, you know, a close approximation of that elusive thing, meaning. It really is. I think the food, the whole re-involvement of people on a visceral level with their food in making it, growing it, baking it, fermenting it, and taking that back from agriculture is it's a renaissance, and it's a really huge movement that's happening, and it's just so valuable in every way. You know, it's kind of like not only it's an integral countercultural approach because it not only sort of tries to eliminate the, you know, industrial foods and that, but it also at the same time reintroduces harmonious cultural values and ways of interrelating. So that's hot.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it'll work, and we'll be making really great bread, and people will be changing their processes and ideas about food.
They're already being influenced. I mean, that the industry's even kind of like doing artisan courses. I mean, that's, it is happening. History, you know, this is a process, you know, which we can, if we can stand off from, you can actually see this happening year by year. So-called industry, which has always been what debases food, kind of being tugged at from a lot of different angles.
Mm.
From the bread angle, from, you know, the point of view of organics and the organic flour now, and this whole, it's, we don't use the term alternative anymore, but there is actually a parallel reality developing, and it's morphing into each other to some extent as they do, but that it's morphing at all, and that, you know, it's only benefits consumers, and it certainly makes more interesting culture.
Sure. Keep us informed on your book. And
okay.
On your bakery, and hopefully you'll have pictures for us.
I will soon, mate, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, keep up your fantastic... I've got to stop entering sourdough sites so much because I get too verbal on too many fronts. But I'll rave with you about stuff. That's really cool. I love to hear what you're doing and what you've done and, you know, what's animating you. It's really... I love it. Yeah, do it. Keep doing it.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Oh, thanks for ringing me and including me, man. Love
all right.
It. Okay, man. See you, okay. Jeremy.
Take care.
Bye, mate.
Ciao.